18. The next morning, Kozlov, true to form, announced it was back to work for the consortium, starting with the usual working breakfast, so Gideon walked down the hill and into Hughtown for something to eat. By now he looked forward to a couple of those D-shaped Cornish breakfast pasties to start the day, and would miss them when he got back home. Egg McMuffins were fine, but nothing like these supremely dense, tasty things that sank to your stomach like so much lead and continued to warm you for hours. Late the previous afternoon, he had met with Clapper for the distasteful purpose of telling him about the numerous antipathies that Villarreal had aroused among the consortium fellows. Clapper, tired and preoccupied, had seemed unimpressed, but that was his affair. Gideon was simply glad to have the task behind him. Today he would be pleased to get back to his own element, Bones. When he came out of the cafe and turned toward the station, he noticed that the fog had abated a bit. Not thinned, but shredded here and there, like torn curtains, so that there were sporadic glimpses of the sound and even the outer islands between thick pillars of whitish-gray. It was like the occasional shadowed sight of Earth you got looking down from an airliner through heavy, broken clouds. He found that being able to see more than a few feet, even intermittently, raised his spirits, so that when he opened the door to the station, he was whistling. Clapper, sitting in Rob's office, cradling a mug of coffee in one hand and holding a cigarette in the other, was looking happy too, and much restored.
"Constable, you made a damned mockery of the majesty and stateliness of force," he was bellowing at Rob.
But he was laughing. Rob looked cheerfully mock sheepish. Clapper waved Gideon in cordially.
"Ah, Gideon, a pleasure to see you. Now what do you suppose this fellow has done to so arouse my ire?" he asked, jerking a thumb at Rob. "Tell him, Constable."
"I'm not really sure, sir," Rob said to Gideon. "Near as I can tell, the sergeant is upset because I donned contaminant restrictive headgear at the crime scene, as I was taught to do at—"
"Contaminant restrictive headgear," Clapper howled. "I'm sitting there minding my own business, interviewing Mrs. Bewley, and I turn around and glance out a window, and there in the passageway I see a horrible sight. Constable Rob, this very Constable Rob, prowling about with a shower cap, a plastic bloody shower cap on his head. Next thing, I expect to see him in a tatty bathrobe and bedroom slippers.
Sarge, they told us at school.
And he had the effrontery to offer one to me as well.
Sarge, the reason—"
Clapper shushed him affably.
"I know, lad, I know. I'm just having yon. You go ahead and do it if that's what they taught you. But please, not in my presence. Gideon, get yourself some coffee and come join us, why don't you? I met Mrs. Oliver yesterday, delightful woman."
"She told me," Gideon said from the other cubicle, pouring coffee into the same mug he'd used the day before, and wishing he'd remembered to rinse it.
"She thought you were delightful too. He was a lamb," were her exact words.
"A lamb," Rob said to the ceiling. "I bet that's a first."
"Au contraire, mon ami," Clapper said, leaning expansively back in his chair, one thick, hairy forearm hooked over it, then switching to an atrocious French accent. "It is that I hear this constantly."
For a guy with two death investigations on his plate, Joey Dillard's and Edgar Villarreal's, and a professional staff of exactly one, he was looking very much at his ease.
"I have something for you," he said as Gideon returned with his coffee. He waved a few sheets of paper. "Yesterday I put in a call to my fellow copper in Talkeetna, Alaska, and asked if he'd be kind enough to send over what they had on the death of Edgar Villarreal, the gentleman supposedly eaten and subsequently deposited by a bear a couple of years ago. Here it is. Not very much of a case file, police report, police surgeon's report, both quite brief, and a photograph of the remains, none too clear. They scanned them into the computer and emailed them, and there they were, waiting for us this morning."
"Ah,"
Gideon dropped into the empty chair, put his mug on the desk, and took the printouts with considerable interest. The police report covered the same ground as the story in the International Herald Tribune. Remains discovered in a bear den, identified as human by one Dr. Leslie Roach, consulting police surgeon, and assumed to be those of Edgar Villarreal, missing from his nearby base camp for the previous 2 years. The surgeon's report added little. 40 bone fragments were recovered, the largest measuring approximately 4 centimeters, and most less than 5 millimeters. A virtually complete second phalanx of a human thumb, measuring 3 centimeters, was found, as was a 5-centimeter rib fragment. Other fragments were too small and splintered to be conclusively identified. Gideon turned to the color photograph of the remains, which had been spread out on a table, first having apparently been cleaned. The picture was either fuzzy to begin with, or had been much degraded in the scanning process, but it was clear enough for his purposes. He placed his finger on one of the bones in the photo, the only complete one. "This thumb phalanx?" he said. "Yes," Clapper and Rob responded. "It's from a sheep, maybe a goat." "Goats have thumbs?" Rob asked. Gideon couldn't help laughing. The thing was, Rob was so earnest. "No, but they have breastbones, sternums. And this is the manubrium, the top segment of a sternum. And this," he indicated another bone in the picture, "and this would be the rib fragment he talked about. He's right enough about that, but it's way too flattened to be a human rib. It's from a quadruped, too. Probably the self-same unfortunate sheep would be my guess." With a gesture, he took in the entire photograph. "There's nothing else I can be sure of. This one might be part of a tail vertebra, but that's about it. Definitely nothing to suggest anything other than a quadruped, a bovid. Well, maybe a couple of little mole or gopher bones, or something like that mixed in there too. Ferret, maybe. More than one meal here, I'd say. No reason to think any of it's human." Clapper was expelling smoke from a cigarette and shaking his head. "You'd think a police surgeon would know the difference between a goat and a man." "Well, you know," Gideon said, finding himself again defending the medical profession. "Once he's out of school, a physician never sees a bone all by itself, out of context, which I do all the time. And there are no courses in medical school that teach comparative skeletal anatomy. Why would they?" The same was true for dentists, Gideon knew. His own dentist, in whom he had complete confidence when it came to his own teeth, had once telephoned him in some distress to say he thought he'd found a human infant's mandible in a roadside ditch. It had turned out to be the mandible of a young dog. And when it came to police cases, another factor was at work as well. When the cops walk into your office all excited about the suspicious bone or tooth they brought with them, there is always a subtle but substantial pressure on you, mostly self-induced, to tell them what they've told you they think it is. "Anyway, I don't really think you can blame the guy," he finished. Clapper didn't agree. "The Alaska State Police ought to get themselves another police surgeon, that's all I have to say. Or at least hire a physical anthropologist when the occasion arises." "No argument there." Gideon put down the photograph and picked up his mug. "How's the Dillard investigation going?" Clapper responded with a concise summary. The work at the scene was done, as were the initial interrogations. But they knew little more than they'd known yesterday. Quite a lot of evidence had been collected and bagged at the scene, and was awaiting a change in the weather that would permit it to be sent to the lab in Exeter. But whether or not they were dealing with a homicide, they were having a hard time determining. The matter was complicated, as Gideon would understand, by a number of factors. First, Joey had been in the habit of enjoying a late evening smoke out on the catwalk, and all agreed that he had had more Pim's cup than was good for him at dinner. They expected a more exact finding on that from Dr. Gilly shortly. Was it possible that the deceased, his coordination muddled by drink, had accidentally fallen over the railing, which was indeed dangerously low? The possibility had to be allowed for. Moreover, the only injury Dr. Gilly had found in his on-the-scene examination,
aside from some contusions and lacerations, had been the massive damage to Joey's head, and the problem with that kind of complex trauma, according to the doctor, was that it was next to impossible to determine whether it was entirely the result of a simple fall or might involve something more sinister, such as a blow or blows. It was hoped that the autopsy would shed some light on the cause of death, but,
"You know, I'm not so sure about that," Gideon murmured.
Clapper's eyebrows went up.
"About?" "About not being able to tell whether the head injuries came strictly from a fall or something else was involved. I mean, I don't want to second-guess Dr. Gilly, and I never even saw Joey's body, so I may be all wet, but all the same, there are some criteria that can be used to differentiate between various kinds of blunt force trauma."
But Clapper's attention had wandered.
"Well, yes, that's interesting. I'll put you in touch with Davy Gilly, and maybe you can help him out there."
He shot a look at his watch.
"Kyle, are you ready to go?"
"Ready and eager, sir."
"We're off to the castle for another round of interviews," Clapper explained to Gideon. "Got some new questions for them today."
The phone cheeped. Rob picked it up.
"Isles of Scilly Police Station, good morning,"
he said, and quickly straightened up in his chair.
"Yes, sir, I understand. Of course, sir."
He covered the mouthpiece.
"Exeter," he said to Clapper.
Clapper made a disgusted noise.
"What do they want?"
"They want to talk to you. It's Detective Chief Superintendent Levine."
"Tell him I'll call him back."
Sarge. He sounds like he's not in the mood to wait. It's a conference call. They've got somebody else on, too."
He hesitated.
"It's about Joey Dillard."
Clapper's big hands clamped on the arms of his chair as if he thought they were the necks of two detective chief superintendents.
"Damn his eyes," he growled, pushing himself to his feet and stomping to his office, the door of which he slammed shut behind him.
"He'll be right with you, sir," Rob said brightly.
He listened until he heard the phone in Clapper's office being picked up, then replaced the receiver.
"This may be bad," he said.
"Why, what is it?"
"Well, the other person on the blower is the force pathologist down at the hospital in Trillisk. He does the post-mortems for Southern Cornwall, so I'm guessing he's going to be autopsying Dillard's body after all, which would seem to mean headquarters is going to scupper our investigation and take the case back themselves."
He gestured with the tip of his head toward the window behind him.
"The fog's dissipating pretty fast. They might be able to fly in their mainland detectives now."
"That's not going to make your boss very happy."
"It's not going to make me very happy either," Rob said. "Excuse me."
He picked up the phone again.
"Isles of Scilly Police Station, good morning." "Oh, hello, Mrs. Hobgood. No, I'm afraid we haven't found Eloise yet. Yes, of course, we're actively searching." "No, of course we haven't given up hope. It hasn't even been a full day yet. We'll find her, you'll see. Don't we always?" "Oh, definitely, we'll let you know the moment we do. Don't you worry now."
"Runaway kid?" Gideon asked when Rob turned to him again.
"Runaway duck. She keeps her as a pet. Won't use a leash. Loses her a couple of times a month. I'll swing by the wastewater treatment plant this afternoon. Eloise always turns up there to root around after a day or two. I'll pile her in the van and drive her home."
He grinned ruefully.
"What was that again about the majesty and stateliness of the force?"
They hadn't been able to hear Clapper's voice from his office, but they had no trouble hearing the telephone slam into its cradle, and then the squeal of his chair rolling back. They looked at each other, the same question on their minds. When the door opened, who was going to come through it? Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde? It was Dr. Jekyll, smiling and complacent.
"Well, that was interesting."
"They don't want the case back," Rob blurted.
"Want and get are two different things," Clapper said, returning to his chair and his coffee. "I told them to shove it. I'm the case investigator, and I intend to continue being the case investigator, and if I need any of their bloody help, I'll bloody well ask for it."
Rob's jaw dropped.
"You told Detective Chief Superintendent Levine to...
Look, lad," Clapper said kindly. You have to understand the way these things work. I'm still a bit of a, shall we say, a legendary figure there, despite a few problems in my latter days. People are reluctant to get in a row with me, especially the Detective Chief Superintendent. Teddy Levine is 15 years my junior in age and 6 years my junior in seniority. He's never made Officer of the Year, and he has no decorations for valor. And when I really assert myself, which I haven't done now for many a day, when I put my foot down, young Teddy is not the man to stand up to me. With a few face-saving mutterings about making sure to keep the computer log up to date, he withdrew from the fray. The case is mine. Ours. From someone else, it would have been hyperbole. But Gideon had the impression Clapper was telling it as it was, without any self-inflating embellishments. Now, the one thing I can use their assistance on is with the post-mortem. Nothing against Davy Gilly, of course, but the man would be the first to admit that he's not forensically trained. Since Teddy has already arranged for an autopsy with a force pathologist at Trelisk, I've let that stand. A helicopter is on its way to pick up the body even as we speak. Coyle, you'll want to get a hold of Davy right now and tell him to keep his bloody hands off the corpse. Rob immediately got on the telephone while Clapper clasped his hands behind his head and leaned back in his chair, savoring his victory and the job ahead.
Just in time, Sarge. They say the body is already on the autopsy table. Dr. Gilly's about to get started.
Well, tell him to stop where he is and get the body bagged up. Have him send off whatever he's written up to. Oh, and see that a copy of our report goes out to Trelisk along with the body as well.
Clapper, content and serene, leaned back and reclasped his hands, but suddenly sat up straight and smacked his forehead.
Gideon, I forgot, I've left the pathologist hanging on the blower. He has to speak with you. You can take it in my office, line one, if he's still there.
With me? About what? Puzzled, Gideon got up.
He didn't say. I happened to mention your being here, and he said, would that be Dr. Gideon Oliver, the skeleton detective? And I said yes. And he said, may I speak with the gentleman? And there the matter stands.
In Clapper's office, Gideon leaned over the desk to punch line one and picked up the phone.
This is Gideon Oliver. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Not at all, not at all, a bluff, jolly voice declared. How are you, old friend?
The voice was only vaguely familiar. I'm sorry, I don't. This is Wilson Merrill, the voice cried, after which there was an expectant pause.
It took Gideon a second to make the connection, but when he did, it was with real pleasure.
Wilson, he said, how good to hear your voice. Do I understand that you're the Cornwall and Devon pathologist now?
Indeed, yes. My aged mother lives in Falmouth, and Lydia and I are happily settled here now. I left the Dorset Constabulary 2 years ago. We had some fun there, didn't we? Remember Inspector Bagshaw?
Gideon remembered all right. In the annals of successful police bogglement, the experience with Detective Inspector Bagshaw of the Dorset CID was at the top of his list. Gideon had been staying in the coastal village of Charmouth in connection with an archaeological dig nearby, and a rotted corpse had turned up in the bay. Merrill, who knew Gideon by reputation, had been responsible for the autopsy. He had asked Gideon to attend, which Gideon, who hated autopsies, especially on corpses well along the road to putrescence, had reluctantly done. As it turned out, there was so little soft tissue to work with that Merrill had simply turned the remains over to him to see what could be gotten from the skeleton. In less than an hour's time, Gideon had emerged from the autopsy room with his conclusions. The unidentified body, he told Merrill and the supercilious, until then Bagshaw, was that of a large motorcycle rider in his mid-30s who also, by the way, happened to be a left-handed baseball pitcher, not a cricket bowler, a baseball pitcher. Might that possibly be of some help in identifying him?
Fun is not something that is generally associated with forensic anthropology, but this was surely as close to fun as it ever got.
Bagshaw's big, curving cherry wood pipe had actually fallen from his mouth and clattered to the table, scattering ash and tobacco shreds. And the delighted Merrill couldn't have been more pleased. He'd come near to embracing him.
"You bet I remember," a laughing Gideon said now. "Wilson, it's really nice of you to say hello. You know, I'm not exactly sure where Trellisk is.
It's a neighborhood in Truro, really."
"Well, I don't really know where Truro is either, but
just up the road from Trellisk,"
Wilson told him unhelpfully. "But maybe we can get together before I leave. It'd be nice to—"
"I didn't want to speak to you merely to say hello, old man."
"You didn't?"
"No, I want to invite you to the post-mortem. Lend a hand, don't you know?"
He made it sound as if he just invited Gideon to a private reception at the White House. It was Gideon's experience that forensic pathologists in general were a happy, outgoing crew, but he had never met another one quite as exuberant as Wilson Merrill, or one who found so much challenge and fulfillment in the grisly work that took place on the slanted metal tables. But for the notoriously squeamish Gideon, watching a human body get debrained and disemboweled to conduct a post-mortem had about as much allure as watching one get dismembered to conceal a murder, namely zero. And lending a hand made it less than zero.
"To the post-mortem," Gideon said, trying for surprise to light. "Well, I really appreciate that, Wilson, and of course I'd like to come, but I'm not sure how I'd get there."
"No problem there, Gideon. The helicopter should be arriving at St. Mary's any time now for the body. You could ride back here with it."
Well, I'd like to, of course, but I do have some things to do here."
"Nonsense. You can spare a few hours. We'll have you back in St. Mary's by tea time."
"Oh. Well, actually,
I'll see you in an hour, then. It will be a treat to work with you again. We'll have a jolly time of it, you'll see."
"I'm looking forward to it, Wilson," Gideon managed. It wasn't the first time he'd been overwhelmed by Wilson Merrill. Or in this case, only partly overwhelmed. He had to admit that he was extremely interested in having a look at those complex trauma of Joey's skull to which Gilly had referred. It was the process of getting down to the skull that he wasn't looking forward to. Back in Rob's cubicle, he was explaining what the call was about when a clatter overhead drew all three men's eyes to the window. A red helicopter was descending mantis-like toward the open space of Holgate's Green. "Cornwall Air Ambulance," it said on the side.
"Your conveyance, I believe," said Clapper.
"Mine and Joey's," Gideon said.